If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code SPOTIFY to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code SPOTIFY at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code SPOTIFY.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. I'm going to begin today's episode with some exciting news, which is that this podcast is going to be increasing from 2 episodes to 3 episodes a week. New editions will be available to download from all the usual places every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from now on. We hope that you'll enjoy these extra episodes, and please do keep your feedback coming in to podcast@historyextra.com. So on today's podcast, we've got a discussion about some of the biggest misconceptions about the Middle Ages with historian Hannah Skoda. Hannah is a fellow in medieval history at the University of Oxford, and she also recently wrote a piece for our website, historyextra.com, busting some of the biggest myths about the medieval world. For today's podcast, she discussed some of these misunderstandings with our content director, Dave Musgrove.
I'm here with Hannah Skoda, who is fellow and tutor in medieval history at St John's, Oxford, and we're here in the college on a lovely wintry wet day. Hannah's one of our speakers at our Medieval Life and Death Days in 2020, which is happening in London and York. And she's also written a piece for the website History Extra about medieval misconceptions, which is a very interesting read. So that's what we're going to chat about. I suppose the first question, before we get into these misconceptions, is we ought to try and in some way define or characterise what we mean by the medieval period, which I know is a bit of a tricky thing to do. You work in late medieval period, really, and your interests are geographically quite broad, Britain, France, Germany, Italy. European, yeah. Italy. Is there any way to meaningfully characterise what the medieval period is in terms of dates or anything else?
It's a really interesting question. So generally, when we talk about the Middle Ages, we mean around the year 400 to around the year 1500. but it's really problematic trying to identify a start and an end date, because as soon as you do that, you're making a series of judgments about what historical events you think are more important than others. So whilst many historians, you know, kind of quarrel about whether the end date should be 1485 or whether the end date should be 1520, I think actually most people now would rather go with a very broad definition, which enables us to think more widely about these issues.
And is there anything at all in terms of the later medieval period, the area where you have most special, is there anything that ties that period together? Are there any sort of broad themes that we could talk about?
So I'm particularly interested in the period from around 1300 to around 1500. And what strikes me particularly about that period is just that it's a moment of absolutely cataclysmic change, really. It feels in many ways like the world sort of turns upside down. And I think contemporaries were really aware of that. So at the moment, I'm working on nostalgia in the later Middle Ages. And one of the reasons I think that there was a kind of wave of nostalgia in this period is precisely because everything was changing so rapidly. And people just felt like the pace of change was sort of beyond their comprehension. And it was really hard to keep track of, you know, the fact that half the population was dying of plague, that commerce was taking off, that towns were expanding at incredibly rapid rate, that politics was changing beyond recognition in many ways. So, yeah, so I think that period of the later Middle Ages is a particularly striking period just in terms of really, really important structural change.
And you wrote a very good piece for us on this topic for BBC History Magazine, and which is now on History Extra, which everyone should have a read about to understand nostalgia, which is very interesting. So the driving force of this change, was that mostly Black Death then? Is that the key thing that's making things?
That's the most obvious thing. So I mean, the effect of, historians are now estimating that mortality rates were around 50%. Obviously, a bit kind of regionally variable and so on. But the effects of that in social terms and economic terms and cultural terms are in many ways just unimaginable. But it's not just that. It's also that, you know, towns were growing and changing in many ways anyway. Commerce was taking off in all kinds of striking ways in any case. Warfare was pretty much endemic through the 14th and 15th centuries. This is the period of the Hundred Years' War. Amongst other things, cultural change with the sort of early stirrings of humanism, particularly in an Italian context, the development of learning, foundation of lots of new universities. These kinds of things aren't necessarily connected to epidemic disease, but they're all happening at the same time to just really change the landscape.
Yep. Okay. And you're right. I mean, to think of a 50% death rate is just... it just doesn't really bear thinking about, does it? And that in itself would obviously lead to great changes. So okay, so we kind of set the scene a bit, and so now let's just rumble through some of these misconceptions. So what we asked you to do was just think about things that people understand of the medieval period, perhaps the ways that they're seen in a cultural environment now, which aren't necessarily completely accurate. So I'm just going to run off the first one of the list that you wrote for us, which was that women were so oppressed that they never did anything of interest, which is you know, is a great statement, a great comment to make. So that's not true, is it?
No, it's not true. It's certainly a deeply, deeply misogynist, patriarchal set of societies that we're talking about when we're looking at the Middle Ages. And I wouldn't want to deny that in any way, that the kinds of structural oppression and disempowerment that women faced are just appalling in many ways. But at the same time, many women responded to this and reacted in incredibly strategic and intelligent and sophisticated ways. And there's been a kind of misunderstanding amongst many historians, I think, for a long time as well, that we can't really write proper histories of women because we don't have the documentation to do it. And again, that's just not true. There are lots and lots of documents showing that, you know, women were individuals and they did all kinds of interesting things right across the social spectrum. So we know of really famous examples like, you know, Eleanor of Aquitaine or Blanche of Castile. We know of incredible peasant women who achieved amazing things like Joan of Arc. But we also know about women who you know, didn't necessarily become particularly famous, but nevertheless lived independent and really quite exciting lives in many ways. So, for example, we know that women were involved in the brewing industry in a really big way. And there are many examples of extremely successful brewsters who were women. There's a really lovely example I came across recently of three women from Halesowen near Birmingham. And there's nothing particularly special about them. They just happened to crop up in a document where they were tried for false trading in the town. And this enables us to know that they'd immigrated to the town together from a neighbouring village. And they then supported each other in trying to find a kind of economic way of surviving, effectively. And we then find one of them tried again in the early 14th century, about 10 years after the initial case. And she's tried for harbouring a thief. It turns out the thief was her daughter. So it's a lovely example of women sort of sticking together, of, you know, moving because they're desperate. They move to the town because they're trying to find a way of surviving. They find the only way possible. They then get prosecuted for false trading. But again, the kind of solidarity between them is really striking.
So women had much more agency than perhaps they've been given credit for in previous writers. It's very interesting that you talked about the sources that you were using there. So one would imagine that it's quite hard to find the individual voices of the less exalted, men and women in the period, but more specifically women. But are you saying that's really not the case? And if you look at court rolls or other legal records like that, then you can find their voices.
Exactly. We don't have many letters from this period, and we don't have diaries. And, you know, that's really frustrating because it would be amazing if we did. But if you think outside the box a little bit and turn to legal records in particular, you can find all kinds of places where women speak up effectively. And, you know, the case of Joan of Arc is an amazing example because we have this enormously long trial record for her. But there's many, many other cases where women are being tried or indeed prosecuting somebody else for a much more minor kind of offence, in which case all sorts of details about their lives are revealed. Yeah. And then material culture tells us a lot about women as well. So surviving kind of archaeological remains and textiles and things like that.
Yeah.
Really informative.
Yeah. But one of the jumping onto one of your other misconceptions about violence, which is one of your sort of your big areas of research, and you've written for the magazine about it, but also tying that in with women here. I recall in the feature you wrote that you were basically saying that the medieval world wasn't necessarily quite as violent as we imagine it to be, but there was quite a lot of element of violence against women. Is that right? Tell me about violence and what sort of a society it was. So the misconception you're saying is that medieval people were brutal and mindlessly violent, and again, that's not quite true.
So it's really, really difficult to assess actual levels of violence in the Middle Ages. There's no police force at this stage. We don't know what proportion of violent crimes are actually being prosecuted. Their definitions of violence are different from ours. Different things are acceptable, unacceptable, et cetera, et cetera. So doing something statistical is really difficult. I think, nevertheless, it's pretty hard to deny that levels of violence, or at least levels of interpersonal violence, were higher then than they are now. But what I find really striking is that people worried about it a lot. They really agonized in a whole series of contexts. So the ways in which they thought about violence legally indicate some really sophisticated thinking and changing thinking about what's acceptable and what's unacceptable. We've then got a whole series of literary sources, which again suggest that sometimes they think violence is absolutely the right response. Sometimes they can see that this just leads to absolute chaos and that it's incredibly destructive. But the line between those two is a really difficult one to deal with. So it's that kind of sophistication and agonizing about whether violences are a good or a bad thing, which really is striking about the Middle Ages, I think.
But do we know whether, and I imagine this is very hard to answer, but would it have been normal for somebody to walk down a street and assault somebody else if they had done something to offend them? Or is that, because that is what you see in some of these, you know, films and such like. And I guess there must be a social gradation there is that, you know, if someone is of a higher standing, then they can do things to people who are beneath them that otherwise wouldn't be.
Legally, you can't. You can't ever just beat someone up because you feel like it. Nevertheless, if you're a nobleman and you do that to your serf, say, in many cases, you simply won't be prosecuted. And in any case, the penalty is certainly a lot less than if it's the other way around, where it's absolutely catastrophic. Yeah. The same, you know, in a domestic abuse context as well. If a husband beats his wife, that is not okay the vast majority of the time. But if a wife assaults her husband, that's bordering on treason. And if she murders her husband, that's treason. That's not just murder. So there's certainly a sense that, you know, it's petty treason. So status sort of plays into this. But it's never okay just to walk down the street and punch somebody because you feel like it. So it's not normal. But at the same time, I think it's probably relatively common in some contexts.
Yeah. And just thinking a bit about the sources that one might use to analyse these sorts of things, you've just mentioned a few different ways that you can understand things, like your literary source and things like that, and the difficulties of doing any sorts of statistical analysis. You would imagine if you're doing certain sorts of medieval history, if you're looking particularly to try and understand the finances of the state, then there are certain obvious sources that you would look at because they contain it. But to understand social trends, you're going to have to look much more widely. How do you work out where you're most likely to find something that's going to be interesting?
Gosh, that's a really difficult question to answer generically. So some people start with, you know, an amazing body of sources that they've discovered, and then they just, you know, go through that particular corpus of sources and think about what that tells them about the particular period that they're looking at. Most people, I think, would rather come with a question in the first place, and then they have to think very carefully about what sources to look at. So, for example, I wanted to look a few years ago at interpersonal violence in northern France. It turned out that the region I was interested in was a region of customary law, which was largely unwritten, and that they tended not to keep detailed legal records. What they did keep was financial accounts. And in those financial accounts, they would detail all the payments made by people who'd been prosecuted. So payments as punishment. And they'd also detail all the payments for hangman's rope and the executioner's fee and stuff like that. So again, by sort of thinking outside the box, you can find a way into the particular question, even when that body of sources no longer exists.
Okay, and that obviously is one of the ways to challenge some of these misconceptions. Let's have a go at another one, which is a nice one to try and take down. Everyone was short and died young. This one is where you could possibly get some more statistical analysis, I would imagine, because you've got skeletal remains, for instance.
Exactly. I mean, I think this is something where archaeologists are the real experts who can give us really detailed and really concrete insights. The difficulty with archaeological analysis is always that it's very tempting to extrapolate from, you know, a couple of skeletons that you happen to have found and to draw a much, much bigger picture. But the more this evidence is put together, the more it appears that the differences in height and in age of death are just much less dramatic than we'd thought. I've also found it very striking in the sources, in the documentary sources that I've looked at, to find many witnesses being summoned in legal cases who were in their 80s or in their 90s. So clearly not everybody lives till in their 80s or 90s, but it's not that unusual either.
Mm. Which leads you to then think about the nature of old age in this period. I'm not sure if that was one of your misconceptions or not. I don't think it was. But I mean,
I had childhood, but I didn't have old age.
we'll go to childhood in a second. But I mean, you know, living to a ripe old age is in itself a bit of a misconception, because you kind of expect it to be a much more youthful population.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, I mean, our views have been slightly skewed by the fact that infant mortality is extremely high.
Yeah.
And that makes life expectancy look shorter than it perhaps was if one got through that initial stage.
Yeah. Let's leap on to that, the childhood ones, because that is a great one, isn't it? We kind of think that there is no concept of childhood in the Middle Ages. You're born, you're breastfed, and then suddenly you're sent off to, you know, to peel turnips or whatever, and that's you. And there's no moment of childhood. Tell us why that's not.
They think about childhood in all kinds of really, really interesting ways. And there's lots of ways into this for us as historians. So we could think about medieval schooling, which is really very common and really takes off in the later Middle Ages as well, with the foundation of lots of schools to try and provide kind of elementary and then potentially kind of grammar school education for young people. We could think about it via material survival. So we could think about toys and also really cute clothing that survives for children as well. I saw recently a beautiful image of a little boy playing with he's got a little baby walker that he's kind of trotting around the room in. And it's from about 1300. And it's just so sweet. And the baby walker looks a lot like the kinds of things that my kids have as well. And that suggests that, you know, they're really thinking about children as somehow different from adults, that they have particular needs and they want to accommodate those needs. We could think about it as well in terms of what they had to say about disciplining children. And again, there's a very clear sense that children should be disciplined. But at the same time, there's a sense that, you know, they're children and what's discipline going to achieve? And you've got to be moderate about it. And there's a whole conversation which emerges around that question, which is really interesting.
But just thinking about, schooling particularly, there must be a big element, again, of social status there, is that, you know, the upper classes, the nobility, would presumably have readier access to schooling than the peasantry. Is that true?
So, I mean, the kind of education that at a noble level one would have expected would have involved private tutors. Schools are generally intended for middling sorts, really, effectively. A really amazing example is in the village of Ewelm, which is quite near here, in fact, which is a absolutely beautiful medieval village, effectively kind of refounded by Alice Chaucer, who is the daughter of Geoffrey Chaucer, in the 1430s. Anyway, and she endowed a school and some almshouses and a church, and they're all there, and and they've all been in continuous operation since their foundation. So the school is still there, and you can still hear the children playing in the playground. The almshouses right next to it still being used as almshouses, and then there's the church. And there's a real sense that the point of a medieval community was to care for people across the social spectrum from their birth through to their death. So, you know, Alice Chaucer is there to, extremely paternalistic sort of way, look after the people of the community by providing schooling for them. Then they go and work. And then when they enter old age and can no longer look after themselves, there's a possibility of them being looked after in the almshouses. And they're all supposed to go to church all the time.
Okay. Moving on slightly from the education aspect, another one of your misconceptions that peasants were revolting and irrational, i.e. they were a bit stupid and uneducated, which you've kind of just challenged there anyway. But tell us more about that one.
So I think, the majority of peasants wouldn't have had the opportunity to go to school, I think. So there are some kind of extraordinary examples. But nevertheless, somehow they seem to have acquired really quite sophisticated understandings, both of agricultural practice. And it's been shown that they made some very sophisticated decisions about how to manage their agricultural interests, but also in legal terms, that they had a really striking kind of depth of legal understanding. So there's a wonderful example from the manor of Bocking in Essex. So this is in the early 14th century, and they're really upset with the bailiff, who they feel is making completely unreasonable demands on them as villeins. So they cite Magna Carta 1215, and they cite the manorial customs, and they're aware of these kind of legal protections which are apparently afforded to them, and they win their case effectively, so that the bailiff is castigated for the way he's been treating them, and they get some protections. There's another wonderful example from 1377 of a group of peasants who, again, feel that the dues that are being demanded of them by their lord are completely unfair. They actually hire lawyers to represent them, and they go and purchase a copy of their rights as enshrined in the Domesday Book of 1086, and they cite these in order to demand that their rights should be respected. So these were clearly people who, you know, they were not stupid at all. They knew how to refer to legal documents to try and protect their rights.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
And my favourite scene is a group of students sitting on a boat underneath the petit pont. They're sitting on the Seine and taking off their clerical garb to leap in and have a good skinny dip in the Seine. Yeah, so there's a sense that, you know, the town is a place of entertainment and fun. It's a place of trade and commerce. And it's also a place of suffering because you have beggars and lepers and so on depicted in the same scenes.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh, every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Okay, towns, medieval towns. You kind of imagine them to be terrible, unhealthy, squalid, nasty places. You kind of picture, if you ever go to York, you kind of wander down the shambles and you imagine that place just, you know, just stinking of flesh and blood everywhere and people slinging excrement out of windows and stuff. That can't be right.
Yeah, I mean, I have to admit, I'd always imagined medieval towns as being pretty grim, pretty much as you've just described. But there's been a lot of really recent scholarship, actually, on policing in late medieval towns. So we can't talk about police as such. There's certainly no police force. But we can talk about policing in the sense that they were really keen on regulating and trying to ensure that towns were kept a bit cleaner, that people didn't just dispose of their rubbish and their sewage and that sort of thing in the middle of the street, that people didn't just allow their animals to wander around unchecked and so on.
Yeah. What was the experience of living in a town like? It must have been, in terms of our conception of it, it must have been a lot less clean, a lot less structured.
I think it must have been. And I think it must have been less distinct from the countryside than we perhaps imagine as well. So most towns had an enormous amount of, you know, market gardening and keeping of livestock and that sort of thing going on within the town or the city. I think they must have been fairly unpleasant, I must admit. At the same time, there are lots and lots of really interesting kind of depictions of sort of idealized towns from this period. It's very hard to know how far they're idealized and how far that's what it was actually like. There's a wonderful manuscript from early 14th century Paris called La Vie de Saint-Denis, which is about the first bishop of Paris, who is called Saint Denis. Anyway, he's in the very, very early Middle Ages. But in the illuminations in this manuscript, they include scenes from early 14th century Paris. So it gives us a lovely sense of what the city looked like at that stage. And there's a whole series of scenes of town life on the bridges of the city. Specifically on the Petit Pont by Notre Dame. And anyway, there are scenes of like dancing monkeys and dancing bears to amuse people. There's a physician holding up a little bottle of urine to inspect it for a customer. There's lots and lots of trading and commerce and that sort of going on. There's a leper sitting there on the bridge with his clappers so that people know not to come too close, but to give him some money. There are people singing. There are people coming in from the countryside with stuff to sell. There's people fishing in the Seine. And my favourite scene is a group of students sitting on a boat underneath the Petit Pont. They're sitting on the Seine and taking off their clerical garb to leap in and have a good skinny dip in the Seine. So, yeah, so there's a sense that, you know, the town is a place of entertainment and fun. It's a place of trade and commerce. And it's also a place of suffering because you have beggars and lepers and so on depicted in the same scenes.
It's very, the point you made about the distinction between town and country seems very interesting to me, because quite often when you see a medieval film, you know, a depiction of medieval, the peasants come in from the country and they're wide-eyed at the great, you know, the enormous change that they see when they wander into the streets of London or whatever. Do you think
so that's... I mean, in the Middle Ages, I think they try to present cities as very distinctive, but I don't think they're as distinctive as they are nowadays, if that makes sense.
Okay.
There's a great little story from 13th century France about a peasant who goes to the town to sell his whatever he's been growing, his turnips or something. And anyway, he arrives in the town and he takes the wrong street in to get to the market by mistake. He goes through the street with all the perfume sellers. And he just cannot stand the smell of all this perfume. So he faints in the end. And the townspeople discover the body of this peasant who's fainted, realise what's happened, that he just couldn't take the sophistication of the urban smells. And so they throw him onto a dung heap, at which point he comes round. He goes, oh, thank goodness for that. Now it smells familiar. So, yeah, it's a little 13th century story about how towns are completely different from the countryside. But I think that's part of their whole process of trying to kind of elevate themselves above their surroundings.
Brilliant. Okay, we'll do a couple more. This one is nice. Medieval people had no sense of humour, which is, you know, you have Monty Python depictions of them being somewhat humour. So can we see humour? Can we see a sense of humour in there?
Yes, definitely. Sometimes it's humour that I think really does appeal to us. Like the little story I just told, I find that quite funny.
Yep.
Sometimes it's... I just find it absolutely not funny. It's kind of abhorrent. And so, you know, in a sense, it's a good reminder of alterity, of difference. They're very different from us. These are very different societies with very different senses of humour. Very often it's completely obscene. And sometimes it's very, very violent. So the idea that one would make fun of people with physical difference or, you know, humiliate people, that's deemed to be completely hilarious. But what's really interesting is that they see humour as something really positive. So I have a quotation from a medieval joke book here. This is from the 15th century joke book of Poggio Bracciolini.
Perfect. Is this going to make me laugh?
No, this is just about why humour is important. It's actually rather pompous.
Okay.
He says, it's proper and almost a matter of necessity commanded by philosophers that our minds, weighed down by a variety of cares and anxiety, should now and then enjoy relaxation from its constant labours and be invited to cheerfulness. Anyway, so that's his introduction to a kind of book of cracker jokes, effectively,
right,
from the 15th century. There's another great story from the 13th century about two Englishmen on a holiday in France. And one of them gets a bit ill while he's there. And he says he's just got to go to bed because he feels so lousy. And his friend says, is there anything I can do to help? He says, yes, I think lamb stew, that would really help me, make me feel a bit better. So his friend goes off to the butcher's to try and buy some lamb. But because he's English, he can't pronounce the N sound of the French word agneau for lamb. So he says he wants some anneau. So the butcher gives him some baby donkey because he thinks it's like the diminutive form of the French an, of donkey. So he gives him some baby donkey meat. They go home, make this stew, and not realising that it's baby donkey meat. Both think it tastes a bit strange. Finally realise that it was because of the mispronunciation. And then the two friends burst out laughing, and the one who was sick is cured from his illness by the act of laughing.
Oh, there we
are.
So
the whole story is about how, you know, laughter can make you better again.
I'm just brought to mind of some of the scenes in the Bio Tapestry. I know it's slightly earlier than that, yeah. But there's some elements of sort of slapstick in there with some men messing around with spades and yeah. things like that. But also there's some quite graphic scenes of nudity and things like that, which I don't know whether yeah. they are supposed to be in any way humorous or not. But you can, you know, even in that document, you can see yeah. quite a lot.
Actually, and that makes a really important point, that what's really striking about the Middle Ages is they don't see anything inappropriate about putting humour beside really serious stuff. You know, you don't need to feel that humorous material is a separate genre from serious material. And that's a much later idea, really, that, you know, the humor should be separate from tragedy. So you can put the whole lot together and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Right. One last one then, because we need to save a few of these misconceptions for people to go to the website and read about. But this is sort of going into the whole mindset of the medieval person, that religious dogma meant that no one fought for themselves. So we kind of think that everyone's lives in the Middle Ages is entirely ruled by the church, and you know, that they can't diverge from the teachings that they have. Is that? I mean, but presumably people did do things differently.
So there's certainly an element of truth in that, because this is the period of the foundation of the Inquisition.
Yeah.
Heresy is a thing, and if you are convicted as a heretic, then you are burned. And unequally, in kind of intellectual contexts where people are debating really serious fundamental religious questions, there are moments of extreme censorship. Say the 1270s are a moment when there's a real kind of clampdown. But in general, I think one could really say that this is a period of really expansive intellectual argument and debate about religion, and about, you know, the proper way to think about the nature of God, for example. So they're addressing the really fundamental questions, and they're not afraid to do so. And then in a wider sense, just practically, in a way, the church can't control everything that people are thinking and doing at a local level. And so we find an enormous kind of range of practices and a really blurred line between kind of orthodox official religious practice and the kinds of things that people are doing at a local level. So there's the famous example of the Holy Greyhound from the south of France, where the villagers had decided that this greyhound who saved the life of a baby was actually a saint and could work miracles. I've got here, this is a little facsimile of a pilgrimage badge of John Shawn, who was at Oxford, actually. He was a master at Oxford, and then he was the priest at North Marston in Buckinghamshire, not very far away from here. And he's famous for having dealt with a problem that the villagers had with the devil by popping the devil into a boot. So that's what's shown in this little pilgrimage badge here. This is John Shawn, and he's holding the boot, and here's the devil, which he's popping into the boot. Brilliant. Anyway, this was a miracle which was never sanctioned by the church, because it's a little bit bizarre apart from anything else, and became a really, really popular pilgrimage site. So North Marston now has an enormous church because so many pilgrims went there who wanted to visit the relics of this man who popped the devil into a boot, and the pilgrims would buy themselves a souvenir like this badge. Or apparently this is the origin of the jack-in-the-box. You could get a little toy with a boot. You could pop the devil in, and then it'd pop out, and you could pop him back in. Anyway, but again, it's just a nice example of the way in which popular religious beliefs and practices expanded way beyond what the church was telling people. And the church didn't necessarily have a problem with it. So John Shawn, they were, you know, reasonably happy about the whole thing, even though they never officially made him into a saint.
Okay, I'm going to take a photo of that pilgrim badge in a second on my phone, and we'll try and get that on the website so people can refer to it once we're talking. But I mean, you kind of imagine the medieval landscape to be one rife of superstition and magic, and, you know, sort of a sense that there was magic things going on. Is that was a reality for people?
I think probably yes. There's lots of really interesting surviving material about medieval amulets. Which were used particularly by pregnant women, and would come with little scrolls with a text that you could read out, which is kind of Christian. Like, it would say, I don't know, Mary, Mother of God, and you're supposed to kind of say it five times while jumping over something or other. Yeah. So there's a sense in which it's sort of magic, it's sort of Christianity. There's a really blurred line between the two, I think. One figure who's really interesting right across the Middle Ages is the figure of St. Thomas. Who's the, so he was the apostle who didn't believe that it was Christ when he first saw the risen Christ. And he said he wouldn't believe him until he'd seen the marks on his hands to show that he'd actually been on the cross. So he gets known as Doubting Thomas because he doubted when he was confronted with the figure of the risen Christ. They think about Doubting Thomas a lot in the Middle Ages, and they conclude that he's a really positive figure for Christians to look up to because he embodies their kind of spiritual quest for understanding. So that suggests that actually they think doubt is not a bad thing, that questioning and thinking and wondering about the nature of one's faith is actually in many ways something to be encouraged.
But presumably not outright.
Not atheism. Too much. You just have to get it just right.
Yeah. So. Okay, right. So we've covered quite a few of those misconceptions now, all very interesting things. And that, as I said, there are a few left that that people can go and read about on the website and find out a bit more. But I'm just wondering, as a final final thought, let's assume we've got a time machine working and we could go back to, I don't know, 13th, 14th century Canterbury and stand in a street. How alien would it feel to us, do you think? Would we be feeling like we are in a completely foreign land by going back there?
It's a really, really interesting question. I think it would feel very different, I must say. I don't think it would feel completely alien, and I think one would be able to find one's way around and manage and communicate and to some degree feel a sense of commonality with the people around one. But at the same time, I think everything would look so strange and just the kind of sensory experience would feel utterly overwhelming in many ways.
Okay. Hopefully you'll be writing more for us again in the future. Have you got what are you working on now? Have you got another book coming out?
I'm still working on the nostalgia thing, so hopefully that book will appear soon. It's a long process.
Okay. Thank you very much.
That was Hannah Skoda. Hannah is also one of the speakers at our Medieval Life and Death Days, which are taking place at the British Library in London on March the 14th and St John's University, York on 16th of May 2020. Tickets for those events are on sale now. Just visit historyextra.com/events for more details. If you want to read Hannah's article on the subject and see the pilgrim badge that she refers to in the conversation, go to historyextra.com/misconceptions. And do check out the January issue of BBC History magazine, where the cover feature delves into the world of medieval hygiene. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back, as I mentioned before, on Wednesday, when Jack Fairweather will be sharing the remarkable story of a secret agent who broke into Auschwitz.